From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In an age of disinformation and misinformation, where right-wing authoritarians are on the rise, an unlikely institution battling such dangerous trends has emerged in the form of an international collective of citizen journalists and computer sleuths. Bellingcat, founded by my guest Elliot Higgins, is the force behind bombshell revelations centered on the Syrian war, Russian political persecutions, and pro-Trump white supremacists in the U.S. Elliot Higgins is founder of Bellingcat, and he now joins me to discuss his new book, We Are Bellingcat, Global Crime, Online Sleuths, and the Bold Future of News. He's on the Technical Advisory Board of the International Criminal Court in The Hague and was a visiting research fellow at King's College in London, as well as UC Berkeley. Welcome to the program, Elliot.
Thank you for having me on.
So first, tell me about the story that blew open this method of investigation that you start your book with as well, a story that was set in Britain that involved Russia and involved a very sinister story of one state, you know, basically carrying out an attempted murder in another state.
So we open in the book with the poisoning of the Skripals in Salisbury. Sergei Skripal was a former Russian spy who defected to the UK, and he had been out with his daughter, and then they both suddenly fell extremely ill. They were discovered on a park bench in Salisbury, and it was soon established that they'd been poisoned, and the poison was identified as something called Novichok, which is a poison that was developed in Russia. And our investigation examined two individuals who are identified by British authorities as suspects. And these two suspects, they appeared on Russia Today, Russia's state international news channel, claiming to be sports nutrition salesmen who had visited Salisbury to see the 123-meter spire of the cathedral, as they described it. We looked into them, and using various sources from publicly available information to leaked databases from the Russian government itself, were able to establish that they were not sports nutrition salesmen, but they're in fact two GRU officers, members of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Services. We not only managed to connect them to the poisoning, but we connected them and their same military unit, Unit 29155, to a previous attempted assassination in Bulgaria. That then led us to a Russia's secret chemical weapons program, where they were manufacturing Novichok. And eventually in 2020, in August, after Navalny, the Russian opposition leader, was poisoned, we connected those same chemical labs to a FSB team, a domestic spy team, who were involved with the Navalny poisoning. They'd followed him on 40 separate occasions, including the time he was poisoned. And that eventually led to one of the team who were involved with that giving a confession to Navalny after he called him up and tricked him into telling him about the operation by pretending to be one of his superior's assistants.
So you were able to fathom something that Scotland Yard couldn't. And you did it not by getting access to leaked documents or classified information. You did it using publicly available tools. How is that possible?
I mean, this was a case where we used a mixture of information. Part of it was publicly available information. Russia is rather unique in that it's a police state that's also intensively corrupt from top to bottom. And there's been a long existing market of data, basically people who know people who work in government offices who will sell information about, you know, someone's phone records, for example. So we started off by using these leaked databases that have been floating around on the internet for a long time, which in itself is open source information because it's freely available. And first we looked into the identities of these two individuals that were presented by the British state and the identities they traveled under. And we discovered they didn't exist in older databases from before 2013. They like popped into existence in 2013. And as they clearly weren't 5 years old, we realized that these were fake identities. We are then able to used these data brokers who were able to provide registration forms for their passport documents. And on those documents, it had their photographs, so you could be sure it was the same people. But it also had some very mysterious information. For example, it was stamped with the phone number of the Russian Ministry of Defense, as missing a lot of key information about their older passports, which again indicated these were false identities. And then by using details from their fake identities, for example, their first name, their date of birth and the place of birth, we could actually compare that to other people on these databases that had been previously leaked and discovered there were people with matching information. And one of those people in one case was actually a GRU officer who we looked up and discovered was the same person who was appearing on Russia Today saying they were a sports nutrition salesman. So with that one, it was kind of a mix of different information. And in a lot of our investigations, we're using what is purely open source information. So this is information that could be anything from YouTube videos, social media posts, satellite imagery on Google Earth, and combining those to fact check and verify information and building understanding of a range of different events.
Now, you refer to Bellingcat as an intelligence agency for the people, but don't you end up relying on a lot of essentially surveillance of ordinary people that is publicly available?
In a sense, I mean, people are surveilling each other nowadays. I mean, we're surveilling ourselves, really. Mm. We're constantly sharing information about ourselves on social media, taking photographs of ourselves, talking about other people and what they're doing, saying what interesting things that have happened. And in a normal day-to-day life, that might not be too interesting. But if you take the example of downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, which is one of the first big investigations Bellingcat did, what people were talking about then on the day were, first of all, seeing a Buk missile launcher being transported through eastern Ukraine, taking photographs of it, videos. Then they were talking about seeing a launch of a missile where there were photographs and people saying, I've seen a missile coming from this direction. And by combining all that information, it actually gave us an impression of this really important event that had happened and the build-up to it prior to MH17 being shot down. So what we're looking for in a sense is are the kind of echoes that are being created of events happening in the real world that are then creating these echoes online that we kind of pick up on and then kind of trace back to their source and then use the kind of network of information that's being created around it to figure out exactly what's happened. And this is something that we've been, you know, doing very successfully now for a number of years.
Let's talk about Syria. The Syrian war is one of the most devastating wars that continues to be fought, even if it slips out of the news headlines. You write that you had never visited Syria, didn't speak Arabic, but became intimately involved in studying this war, and ultimately were able to link a devastating and deadly attack to the forces of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And it's really interesting because there's some there is a split on the left in the United States over Syria, and a lot of, you know, confusion and sometimes deliberate confusion around what Bashar al-Assad is actually responsible for, and accusations, if U.S. intelligence agencies are involved, accusations of politicizing, you know, attacks or responsibilities for attacks. So tell me about the story in Syria and why your investigation really should lay to rest any doubts about the culpability of the Syrian president.
Well, when I started blogging in 2012, I hadn't come from like a professional background. I was really doing it as a hobby because I'd spent the last year or so kind of on internet forums kind of arguing about what was happening in the conflict in Libya, first of all, and then later Syria. And my interest in the kind of events of the Arab Spring was really kind of fueled by when I was a teenager. It was kind of bookended by the first Gulf War and then 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. So I was kind of very interested in kind of left-wing politics around kind of US involvement in the Middle East. But as kind of time went on, I was kind of then drawn into kind of online discussions because I spent a lot of time on the internet and saw more videos and information being shared from these countries that were being debated over. You know, people were saying, well, this was video has shown this, and then people would argue about whether it was real or not. And I kind of just figured out how to verify where video was filmed, first of all, and just got more and more interested in using these techniques to understand more about these conflicts I was interested in. Then I started this blog and started writing about Syria. And because I couldn't speak, Arabic, I focused more on the arms and munitions that were being used, because most of them were from the former Soviet Union and therefore were extremely well documented online by kind of arms and munition nerds, basically. So it was very easy to identify a lot of these weapons if you did the digging. And I basically did that for a year. And then that took me up to the kind of August 21st, 2013 sarin attacks, where there was a huge amount of video footage posted online compared to any other event in Syria before, around 200 videos, most of which showed the victims of the attack, but some showed the munitions that were used. One of which was a very unusual munition that no one had really seen in the conflict before. But I was fairly unique in that I had seen them in the conflict before, because I was the only person who was every day looking at nearly every video I could find of anything that looked interesting in Syria. And these weird looking munitions had turned up before. Not only were these munitions appearing in videos, on the kind of receiving end of their use, but they were also turning up in videos being posted online by pro-Assad forces and even on Syrian state television. And they matched perfectly to the rockets that were being used in the August 21st, 2013 sarin attack. And they became known as volcano rockets. But because I was the only person who was really paying attention to these videos, I was the only person to make this connection. And that really showed clearly that these were weapons that were being used by the Syrian government forces. And then over the years, I just continued to look into more and more chemical attacks. And I think most people, when they think about chemical attacks in Syria, they think of maybe three or four events they've heard of in the media. But, those of us who have kind of researched it very deeply and are working now on the kind of justice and accountability and building cases, in France and Germany at the moment around chemical weapons attacks, there's over 300 chemical attacks have taken place in Syria. It's just the vast majority aren't reported at all in the Western media. So most people have a kind of false impression of the scale and the degree to which chemical weapons are being used in Syria.
Wow. You also write in your book about WikiLeaks, which enjoys a lot of support on the left in the United States. And often when we think about, citizen-led accountability of intelligence agencies and governments, WikiLeaks often comes up. But you say that WikiLeaks is not was about leaking classified information, which is different from what your organization, what Bellingcat does. Can you expand on that a little bit more in terms of the difference between accessing information and making it public versus actual sleuthing, actual investigation, connecting dots through evidence-based research?
Yes. Yeah, so what we're doing at Bellingcat is we're using publicly available information. So we aren't leaking information that, we've been provided that, we can't, say, it hasn't been unaltered, for example. We're just saying, here's a YouTube video from an airstrike in Yemen, and here's the remains of the bomb that was used. And maybe there's another video that shows the moment of bombing or other details, and taking all those kind of separate pieces of information and showing how they relate to each other and using various techniques to verify this information. And for example, taking collections of videos, putting them in sequence, showing where they were filmed. So it gives you a much better understanding of what was actually happening, then comparing that to other information, for example, witness statements that might appear on social media accounts or through human rights kind of reports, and then comparing them to the kind of visual evidence that we've been able to gather, cross-referencing that against things like satellite imagery, for example, to show, that bombing occurred between a certain, certain date range or something like that, to continually kind of test the kind of questions that we're coming up with. Also, we're not just, although we're seen often as a journalism organization, we're also, doing a lot of work around justice and accountability, looking at the processes we've kind of developed, doing this as amateurs and turning it into a more professional way of archiving evidence for investigations, analyzing that evidence, and then being able to use that in a courtroom environment and testing that actually with mock trials and with international bodies to see that what we're developing is actually a solid process for investigating war crimes. So really we're more about the kind of investigation element of it than the kind of producing information for other people to look at and piece through.
Is there a moral imperative here? I mean, often journalists, who work to do this sort of research, it's not a lucrative field necessarily. People do it because they want to shine a light on the inner workings of political issues. They want to shine a light on what elites are doing. They want to expose hidden information in the interest of strengthening or furthering democracy and human rights. Is there a moral imperative here?
I think so. And I think one thing that I've kind of learned over time, and I started doing this really because I was arguing with people on the internet. It wasn't a very noble pursuit to begin with, but I've really, I've met activists, I've met people who've worked in human rights, I've watched people, met people who, are involved with cases, and the value of open source evidence, especially coming from conflict zones where often the best evidence you can get is video footage filmed on the ground by people who are witnessing what's happening, is increasing every single day. And to me, I mean, we're a small organization, and we've expanded quite a bit, from where we started as a kind of one person blog with a bit of money from Kickstarter. But now we have 20 staff members, and there's kind of more and more topics that could use really good open source investigation. It's unfortunate that, there's so few of us able to do this, that we kind of have to pick and choose which ones we look into. There's a lot going on in Sudan at the moment, in Myanmar, and all these other locations where there just isn't enough kind of focus and energy because there's just not enough open source investigators to do the work. And it's really sad, really, because there is so many clear examples where we've investigated stuff where we've added value to something that otherwise would have not been investigated. And through our work at Bellingcat, as we train people, we share our skills and we work with different types of organizations and build a network of not just kind of professional investigators, but drawing our kind of community that's appeared online on platforms like Twitter and get involved with investigations. We hope to have as many people as possible involved with these kind of investigations.
How have state-run news agencies attempted to counter the work that you do? Because there is so much information out there. It is really quite easy to flood the internet with false information, to create deep fakes, to spread propaganda, to kind of create and craft narratives that run counter to facts. And there are, agencies like you mentioned, RT, which is Russia's state agency. Do you find that the work you do is often battling for space and legitimacy alongside some of these other efforts that are trying to control the narrative?
I mean, generally not, because the state media, if they're talking about an event, they're presenting what's clearly a kind of biased viewpoint on it. It's, sometimes they're even lying or repeating the lies of their government. I mean, we've done a lot of work on Russia on a range of topics, and you do get used to the amount Russia lies about every single little thing. I mean, I tell people, if you want to learn how to do open source investigation, fact check a Russian Minister of Defense press conference on any topic, because they'll probably be lying about something even when it's completely unnecessary to do so. But there's an understanding of that, I think, among many people, that this information that's being presented by state media, especially if it's being sourced from states, is not reliable whatsoever. And with Bellingcat, because what we're presenting is evidence and we're explaining how we've analyzed the evidence, it makes it a lot easier for people to actually kind of trust it. Because from the very first days I started blogging, I knew that no one had any reason to trust what I was saying or care about my opinions. All I could do is be as transparent as possible about both the sources and how I was coming to the conclusions I was making about what I could see in those sources. And over time, that kind of built trust in the work I was doing, and that allowed Bellingcat to be founded and our network to expand. So whilst they might be pushing out a lot of disinformation and false claims, they aren't presenting evidence really. And if they do present evidence, then we can fact check it. And we have done that in the past. I mean, one good example is the Russian Ministry of Defense once claimed that they had irrefutable evidence that the US was helping ISIS retreat from its positions and plan to redeploy them elsewhere in the Middle East. And the evidence they presented was a screenshot from a computer game. So, we're not dealing with geniuses here. We're dealing with people who are quite, they are considered clever at doing propaganda because they lie a lot and they don't get called out on it. But what we're doing is calling them out about it.
Tell me about the work that you've done around the January 6th Capitol riot, which, of course, I imagine was, you know, didn't make it into the book because it was just a couple of months ago. On your website, and people can check it out at bellingcat.com, bellingcat.com. There's a number of investigative pieces around some of the participants, some of the rioters, the pro-Trump rioters in the January 6th Capitol attack, which I imagine is also a creative result of a creative use of internet sleuthing.
So we've done quite a lot on the far right in various countries, including the US. You know, we had previously looked into, for example, the Charlottesville, tiki torture march several years earlier. And there we'd collected lots of videos and used that to identify people who'd been involved with violence against counter-protesters. So we decided to do the same thing with the January 6th violence. And we asked people on social media who followed our work if they saw any videos, you know, send them our way. And pretty quickly, we collected about 500 videos from various sources showing all kinds of different things that were happening on the day, some of it including some of the violence that happened. There were also then the parlor videos that were leaked, which added about another 500 videos. And we've spent now, you know, since January 6th, organizing these videos and actually understanding what it shows and how the day developed and what, why the violence occurred, which is actually quite revealing because it shows that part of the escalation was down to the violence of the police against the crowd, who started off, you know, saying Blue Lives Matter and then ended up screaming at them for being traitors when they started tear gassing and throwing flashbangs in the crowd. But we also looked at some of the individuals. For example, there was this Riley Williams. We were contacted by anti-fascist researchers, Antifa researchers, who had found videos that showed her basically being a Nazi. It's simple, we can put it as simply as that. But that was interesting because she was in that video with her face pretty much completely covered. But we used clues in the background of her video, the clothes she was wearing, and other open source information of her and where she lives to identify that even though we couldn't see her face in the video, it must have been her because she was wearing her clothes she had worn in other videos, and the stuff in the background matched in other videos where she was clearly visible.
Hmm. Does one need special skills to aid in the effort that you're engaged in?
Not really. I mean, really what you need is a keen interest in something and a way that, you know, the time to actually look into it. We teach people from all kinds of different backgrounds to do the kind of work that we're doing. I mean, we teach people from kind of 18 to kind of 80, really, with the kind of work we're doing.
Right. There's workshops that people can look up on your website.
That's right. We offer a lot of workshops, and it's really about kind of spreading this to as many people as possible. But, you know, something like geolocation, which is basically looking at imagery and then comparing it to other sources of information like satellite imagery, is basically a more complicated version of spot the difference. But it's something that anyone can really do. You don't need a special tool to be able to do it. Anyone with a decent internet connection and a decent kind of laptop or computer can do this stuff. If you can run Google Earth on your computer and watch YouTube videos, you can be part of an investigation. And one thing that's really great about this, because the entry level in a sense is really kind of, you know, basic, that lots of people can get involved in a whole range of different ways. I mean, some campaigns we've been involved with, for example, promoting the Europol Stop Tracing Objects Stop Child Abuse, where they've asked members of the public to identify objects taken from abuse imagery. We could amplify that to our audience, and that's simply asking people, what is this object? And, you know, anyone can, you know, have a go. And because we're able to actually engage with our audience and crowdsource stuff like that, you know, the offenders have been, you know, arrested. Children have been rescued simply by just engaging with our kind of audience on this question. So, you know, it doesn't have to be hugely complex to be involved, but, you know, being part of a network of people who are engaged is, you know, extremely helpful.
Let me ask you what you think the future of this sort of effort is. Do you imagine that this sort of citizen journalist-led effort can change the institution of journalism as a whole? I mean, it costs money to go to journalism school. The jobs aren't great. Money isn't lucrative, but yet there are such efforts. Do you foresee this replacing journalism or existing, coexisting alongside traditional journalism?
I mean, for me, it's really how society has changed dramatically over the last 10 years, because we've become really connected and, you know, extremely kind of online. And for a big part of that, that's been, you know, quite bad, because really, if you're someone who has lost faith in traditional sources of authority, be it the media, government, or, you know, the healthcare profession or anything like that, you'll look for an alternative online. And often what you're served as an alternative are people who will draw you, often to, asking questions about stuff. But then some people will say, well, you know, I have the answers. And sometimes those answers are effectively conspiracy theories. And that can be anything from Syrian chemical weapon use to the shape of the planet Earth to, you know, coronavirus being a plot by Bill Gates to put microchips into us. You know, not everyone who's looking for an alternative will end up like that, but a certain proportion of people will. And if we don't offer them an alternative where they can actually do evidence-based, you know, investigations and feel empowered by doing that rather than being empowered by screaming at people on the internet, then I think we're in trouble as a society. And I hope with Bellingcat that we can kind of offer that to people. And for me, what I really want to focus on in the future is building these networks and start, you know, teaching people at the age of 16 to 18 how to investigate things locally, you know, engage with people in a way that allows them to feel they can actually have an impact in the world around them without having to find communities online that just ends up making them angry and detached from, you know, reality, basically, whilst thinking they're the real truth seekers.
And those kinds of skills can really sort of inoculate you from the disinformation campaigns that are out there, knowing how to do research, knowing how to back things up, knowing how to follow the sources and really verify the veracity, the truth of the falseness of something is such an important skill these days.
And I think it's really, you know, goes beyond just the question of disinformation, but making people feel empowered and showing them they can actually have an impact in the real world. Because I started doing this just as someone on the internet who was arguing with people who just really wanted to know the truth about a situation. I didn't have any kind of grand ideas about where I could go to or what I could achieve. I just kind of wanted to know what the truth was. And if, you know, I'm as an average person can do that and, you know, achieve what I have, then I'm sure I can teach other people how to do that. And I think kind of the more people there are doing it, the better society is going to be.
Well, Elliot, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to bellingcat.com from our site, and good luck with the book.
Thank you.
My guest has been Elliot Higgins, founder of Bellingcat, an international collective of researchers, investigators, and citizen journalists. And he's the author of We Are Bellingcat, Global Crime, Online Sleuths, and the Bold Future of News. He's also on the technical advisory board of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.